Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. I have a very full lineup with you, but I'm going to introduce each of our guests in turn because I don't want to take any time away from our first guest. His name is Bill Warner. He is one of the most, I think, thoughtful analysts of the threat doctrine we are up against at the moment, in the form of Sharia. Bill directs the Center for the Study of Political Islam and has generated among a dozen books a collection he calls A Taste of Islam series. We're going to talk about the first of these books in what I hope will be the first of many interviews with Bill, with whom I had a chance to have a brief visit while in Nashville, Tennessee last weekend. Bill, congratulations on this body of work, but particularly this series, which seems to have as its purpose trying to make a difficult subject matter and body of material as accessible as possible to the attention deficit and otherwise, flighty American public. Tell us about what you want people to take away from your book, A Two-Hour Quran.
What I want to tell people is you've been lied to. You have been told three things that are simply not true. One, that Islam is just a religion. Two, it's all based on the Quran. And three, Islam is so difficult to understand that you must just sit there and listen, and the government experts will tell you everything you need to know, but it's really too complicated for you to understand.
Right. Or if not the government experts, maybe even they're not able to understand it. Only, Muslims themselves or people imbued with the Middle Eastern culture and tradition, this sort of Orientalist attitude.
Right.
Yeah.
In other words, what the general way of understanding Islam is, we are supposed to listen to experts. And ultimately, the experts' chain of knowledge will come from a Muslim somewhere. So to some degree, what we're being told in the public is, it all depends on what Muslims tell us. And I say that that's making our decisions based on the opinions of experts. But Frank, there are only two experts that count. Those are Muhammad and Allah. And what I've done with this Taste of Islam series is make it so that anybody who can read a newspaper can sit down and actually understand the mind of Muhammad and the mind of Allah. These works are actually quite simple. They've been made obscure by basically bad writing, bad editing. And so everything that's in Islam,
if not by design, I guess, Bill,
well,
as well, there's
now,
that possibility too, isn't it?
As I have plowed through, I tell people what I do in life is to read big, thick, old books and that are very difficult to understand, and I take and make smaller books that are really quite easy to understand. Because what I do, and anyone else could do, is to simply bring the analytic mind of the West to a problem. And we start blowing away all the smoke and dust, and when we get down to the bones of what is really being told, it's really a quite simple story. And
well, before we get to the story, let me just say how you've come to this, Bill. You are a physicist by training.
Yes.
And you're bringing a kind of scientific method of empirical analysis to bear. And one of the things that you've had to confront, of course, as we all do, if we're interested in finding out what's in the Quran, the two-hour version or otherwise, is the seeming inconsistency between what one of these experts, as you call him, Allah, the God of Islam, has said to Muhammad about peaceable relations with unbelievers on the one hand, and a very intolerant, in fact, jihadist direction to make them feel subdued. How did you find this circle is squared in Islam or in Sharia, more specifically?
Well, what I did when I started reading the Quran, I've read religious texts all my life, and I've always read foundational text. So when I approached Islam, it was the same as I would study Taoism or Buddhism. I would want to read its foundational text. And upon reading the Quran, I was immediately struck with the fact that this thing was being made artificially difficult to understand. And Frank, here was my clue. In the Hadith, which are stories about Muhammad, we find that illiterate Arabs are holding arguments about the content of the Quran. Illiterate Arabs. So why were these people able to understand the Quran well enough to argue about it when we find the choosing arbitrarily a Methodist bishop can read the Quran and can't even understand it well enough to argue about it? The reason was simple. The Muslims of Muhammad's day had the context of Muhammad himself, what he was doing, because once you lay out the Quran in the right time order and you lay Muhammad's life out under it, you realize that there is a cause and effect relationship here. Muhammad is the cause, and the Quran is the effect. And in every case, what is being said in the Quran is supporting Muhammad's mission on the ground. So it is Muhammad that gives the Quran meaning. And once you work what Muhammad is doing into the Quran, all of a sudden, you mentioned this early phase, because that's what it was. The peaceful phase is when Muhammad was weak.
Right, in Mecca.
He could not afford to do anything else. But as he accumulates power, you can literally watch the language of the Quran change.
When he moves on to Medina and begins accruing power and the capability to impose his will or Allah's imputed will. We're speaking with Bill Warner. He is the author, among many other books, of a terrific series entitled A Taste of Islam, which can be obtained from the Center for the Study of Political Islam, which he directs. And Bill, give us that website.
www.politicalislam.com. You can get my books there, as well as reading some essays, which I like to think are insightful.
They are indeed. Bill, so I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but you were just getting to the point of something called abrogation. And tell us how that features into this code-breaking that that you and others have done.
Anyone who reads the Quran, much at all, comes away feeling the fact that there's a lot of contradiction in it. And indeed, we know from the Hadith that even in Muhammad's day, the Arabs that were around Muhammad said, you know, you said something else last year. You know, you're very contradictory. And so out comes Allah's prescription that Allah can replace something that is good with something that is better. So therefore, the later Quran is more powerful than the earlier Quran. But Frank, listen to this. It doesn't say that what was said earlier was wrong. It's what was said later was better. So therefore, what came earlier can still be used. And this is what we see in our daily life. In America today, we see Muslims living in a country where Islam is weak. And so therefore, they manifest the Quran of Mecca, which is generally religious. This is a process, however, and that's what's important to know about the Quran, is it describes a process of entering a society and then going through the steps necessary to dominate that society. Mm-hmm. So the Quran describes a process.
So there's a progressive revelation that demonstrates that over time, as you become more powerful, if you adhere to this Sharia program, you are to infuse your so-called religious, you know, approach and belief with a political program that is all about supremacy and domination of others. And Bill, tell us a little bit about the phenomenon of jihad. We only have a minute left, but just quickly, is it about personal struggle in this setting or not?
Well, Frank, being a scientist, I went through all the hadith and sorted out every single hadith that related to jihad. And that is a large percentage. About 21% of the hadith is about jihad. So I took all of the jihad hadith and laid them into two categories, just killing, just war, and something that advocated some form of spiritual advancement, Long story made short, 98% of all the hadith about jihad are about killing. Only less than 2% are about struggle, inner struggle.
Bill, so we're going to have to leave it at that, but we're going to have you back to talk more about the hadiths, which is another subject of your book, The Sunnah of Muhammad. Bill Warner is our guest. Thank you so much for joining us and for this extraordinary contribution to our understanding of the phenomenon of Sharia and the need to counter it. We look forward to seeing you on the 11th of November at the Preserving Freedom Conference in Nashville. Bill, thanks so much for joining us. We'll be talking with you again very soon. Next up, we have Barry Rubin on what is going on in the Middle East at the moment, what it means for you. Straight ahead.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying we're serious about really cutting the budget.
As a backdrop
to this debate about 2011, people make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by Professor Barry Rubin, joining us from Israel, where he has been writing, I think, some of the most interesting, often quite provocative pieces about the condition of the Middle East at the moment and where it seems to be headed and what it means most immediately for his native country, Israel, but for all of us, indeed, in the free world. And Barry, you've done a piece very recently at Pajamas Media entitled The Middle East Today. Ha ha ha. Stop. It's too funny. I can't take it anymore. And this is a rather peculiar way to introduce a very serious topic. But give us a sense of why, what you're getting at with that that headline and why it's no laughing matter.
The lies and misrepresentation of what's going on in the region, especially with regard to Israel, have become so extreme, so exaggerated, so absurd, so departed from the facts that one, it's in no sense in trying to respond to it rationally. one can only laugh and say, this is ridiculous and I'm going to ignore this, other than them laughing at it.
In other words, it would be hilarious if it weren't so serious.
Well, yeah, there's no sense trying to respond to media coverage, academic, political statements that have absolutely no connection to reality. And where the people who are making them are not interested in honest discussion, they're interested in making propaganda. So you can't explain to them why they're wrong, show evidence, and then have people say, oh, I see. Yes, I'll correct that.
Right. Well, let's get into some of the particulars here of what Israel is confronting at the moment, having, as you've indicated, made in the past, particularly, a whole slew of concessions, some of a very strategic nature, as recently as today, making one, I would argue, of a very symbolic nature at a minimum, if not of a tactical one, namely the transfer of 1,000 or more terrorists, some with Israeli blood on their hands, to the Palestinians in exchange for one Israeli prisoner. But what you're facing, and I'd like to get your take both on that idea, but also on what is coming at you from places like Turkey and the Palestinian Authority, Hamas, and Egypt. Give us a sense of the lay of the land.
Well, basically what's happened in the last year or 3 years is that revolutionary Islamist forces have advanced throughout the region, and that not only have Western policies generally not responded to that, but Western elites haven't even realized it's happening. And yet, I think in the span of 60 to 90 seconds, I can demonstrate it clearly. In addition, of course, to the Iranian revolution of decades ago, Turkey is ruled by an Islamist government that's become more and more obviously radical, although I've been writing about its Islamism for years. Egypt and Tunisia are about to hold elections where Islamists are going to come in first place. The Gaza Strip is ruled by Hamas, and more. And this is obviously the key point. But yet, how much do governments, academics, and journalists recognize that there is a terrible threat from revolutionary Islamism, which is advancing steadily and which needs to be countered. And that response is simply not there. I'm wondering whether we're nearing the point where this kind of denial is no longer possible. In other words, after the Tunisian elections on October 23rd and the Egyptian elections on November 28th, will people be able to maintain the same thing into next year? But that's number one on the list. Number two on the list should be the treatment of Israel. Commonly read in the press, Israel has to prove it's for peace. Israel hasn't done anything for peace. We often read, for example, that Israel has refused to negotiate with the Palestinian Authority, whereas since January 2009, the Palestinian Authority has refused to negotiate with Israel. And these are matters of fact. I mean, they're easily demonstrated, and yet they're ignored in the media, columnists, and so on, to the point where you're just living in this bizarre fantasy world.
Right. We're speaking with Dr. Barry Rubin. He is the director of the Global Research in International Affairs Center, better known as Gloria Center, in Israel. He is a man that we turn to quite frequently here at Secure Freedom Radio for an unvarnished, just the facts, ma'am, view of what's going on. And Barry, you've described a series of very profound emerging threats to Israel. I think Syria could be added to that list as well. It's unclear how that will play out, but it seems hard to believe it will be to Israel's benefit. Israel, therefore, will be really, especially with Hezbollah now running Lebanon, completely encircled, with the possible exception of Jordan, though that may be a situation in flux as well shortly. What is it that you think Israel could be doing that it isn't doing right now to placate these demands? Again, I can't imagine why it should, but is there anything that it could?
Yeah. Nothing at all. Nothing at all. No, but first of all, I mean, you made the pessimistic side of the case. There's also another side of the case, which we can go into in a moment. But if you make concessions, you offer compromises, the world ignores them. If what is offered as an alternative is worse than the status quo, then there is no great pressure or encouragement to change things. So I think the policy is basically correct. On the optimistic side, we have to understand a variety of things. First of all, Israel is united and strong. It had the fastest growing economy in 2010, which is the latest we have complete figures for, of all developed countries. Public opinion polls showed last week 88% of Israelis said Israel is a good place to live. 66% said they didn't expect peace with the Palestinians. So people are facing reality and dealing with that. Secondly of all, in some ways, even though everything looks so bad, there is some silver lining there because of the growing division among these Islamist forces with the emergence of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and in a couple of other places. This means for the first time there's a strong Sunni Islamist force. And so these people are saying, in effect, we don't need Iran anymore. And I think that Iran and its power have been weakened, that the Sunni-Shia conflict is increasing. Another line of division is that I believe that for the next two or three decades, that every Arabic-speaking country is going to be marked by a civil war, a civil conflict between nationalists and Islamists and some other forces that are going to tie up a lot of their energy and resources. What's missing here is really, of course, the Western response, Western understanding, U.S. leadership. Everywhere I go, and I just recently traveled in four European countries, people are saying what's needed is U.S. leadership. What's needed is something quite different from the current government. And there are forces, you know, also that oppose in Turkey and Lebanon and Iran in particular. There are forces that Tunisia that oppose revolutionary Islamism. In Syria, by the way, I mean, the Syrian revolution is in a lot better shape to combat Islamism than was the case in Egypt. But I quickly add that the assessments of the Syrian supporters of the Syrian revolution are extremely pessimistic. And they're arguing that the regime is winning and taking over control again.
Yeah. Barry, we're going to have to let it go at that. Thank you for this tour d'horizon. I hope that the optimistic view that you've just described pans out, that the failure of American leadership does not conduce to the Sunnis and Shia deciding this is the moment to move against Israel at a moment, perhaps wrongly, but they see it isolated, and that we will stand shoulder to shoulder with our friends in Israel, as we must. Barry Rubin is the author of the forthcoming book, Israel, An Introduction, from Yale University Press, coming out in January, and you can find out more about his work at rubinreports.blogspot.com. Barry, thanks so much for joining us. Come back to us again soon. Next up, Peter Pham on the latest development, war we're in Africa. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey parents, finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
I'll pick you up after school. Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Peter Pham, one of the country's leading experts on Africa. He is currently the director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council and the author of numerous books and countless articles on this and related regions of the world. And you are our go-to guy, Peter, when things of importance happen in Africa. And, of course, over the weekend, something apparently quite consequential has happened. Namely, the President of the United States has notified Congress that he intends to send something like 100 special forces operatives into four nations of Africa, Central Africa, for the purpose of dealing with a persistent and, in fact, quite odious character. Tell us about the mission and why, in your estimation, it's warranted or perhaps absolutely mandatory.
Well, let me begin by making an observation, Frank, and it's always good to be with you. I find it a bit peculiar, and I'm waiting for a good explanation of why this particular mission merited a War Powers Act notification of the Speaker of the House and the President Pro Tem of the Senate when our entire engagement in the Libya conflict, the administration resisted making the same type of notification.
Yes, so it's a bit peculiar.
It's a bit peculiar, and especially since when one looks at the numbers, 100 special operations forces combat equipment, we've actually had more special operations forces in Africa in recent years in various training missions. So this is not new. So one has to wonder what's going on fully. But
just stay with that for a minute. What do you think is going on? Is it that they anticipate that these forces will actually wind up in combat and they're trying to sort of hedge their bets a bit?
To be quite honest, it's a mystery. There's no seeming consistency, and that might be actually the explanation itself, that we're lacking somewhat of a coherence in our foreign policy. That would not be a surprise.
Well, that actually we could stipulate too, I think.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, but, go ahead. I interrupted you.
No, no, not at all. To the, as you mentioned, this is the group that they're actually on a mission to help the Ugandan, South Sudanese, Congolese, and Central African militaries to root out is a particularly odious group. It's called the Lord's Resistance Army, and it was founded by this high school dropout with messianic pretensions named Joseph Kony. Now, he's been indicted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes and crimes against humanity. In the last 25 years of their rampage, they've kidnapped somewhere between 50,000 and 75,000 children, the boys to be used as child soldiers and the girls to be used as sex slaves. 50 to 75,000 children. They've killed tens of thousands of innocent men, women, and children, displaced in northern Uganda alone over 1.5 million people. So this is a really nasty piece of work. Now, since the Bush administration, the U.S. has been supplying assistance to regional militaries, especially the Ugandan People's Defense Force, to whittle them down. And the African militaries, to be fair to them, have actually done a pretty good job the last several years, so that this group is now down to probably a couple hundred diehard fanatics around their cult-like leader. But the African militaries don't have the capacity or don't have the intelligence and communications to and rapid reaction forces necessary to do that final push and put an end to this. And so the mission, as announced by the White House, is to send 100 U.S. Special Operations Forces in two teams to help guide the local military in carrying out this operation. So eliminating this character would not only be a good thing from the humanitarian point of view, but it also opens up these areas for development. This is an area that's very rich in natural resources, in oil, copper, gold, diamonds, minerals which can not only lift these people out of poverty, but also which the global economy needs. And these are countries that have partnered with us in the past. So in that respect, I think if the mission remains limited, Congress exercises its prerogatives of oversight, then I think, you know, it may be a win-win for everyone. But it has the scope of the mission has to be carefully limited, and it has to be the goals clearly defined.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Peter Pham, of the Atlantic Council, about the extent to which, as I'm frankly just confused about this, there was actually an authorization by Congress of the use of force previously, so that the president is not simply going off and doing this on his own. Did it explicitly translate into an authorization for the use of force, a resolution that was adopted a while back, or is the administration interpreting it that way and perhaps taking certain liberties with what Congress intended?
Well, this is a good example of perhaps unintended consequences or the perils of feel-good legislation. Last year, the House and the Senate both unanimously passed a piece of legislation called the Lord's Resistance Army Disarmament and Northern Uganda Recovery Act, which set four goals as top priorities of U.S. foreign policy. Civilian protection of people in this region, removing Kony and his top deputies from the battlefield without specifying how, bringing in the remaining fighters out of the bush and demobilizing them, and facilitating the delivery of humanitarian assistance. And so it tasked the administration, and it gave the administration actually 6 months to prepare a strategy for how to do this. And the Obama administration last November, in fulfillment of that legislative mandate, presented Congress with a plan, a 33-page document, outlining in some detail various things that could be done. Nothing has happened with that document, at least from the congressional side, although Congress did authorize and demand that document unanimously. And so I think the administration is going to defend itself by saying that it's actually carrying out what Congress ordered it to do and implementing this strategy that Congress listed as goals of the United States.
Yeah. What, as you say, we have here is a bit of feel-good legislation. I think just to be technically correct, you're right. It was unanimously adopted, but it was what they call by unanimous consent, which means that basically if nobody objected, then it was considered approved. And I think there are a lot of people this morning who are probably waking up saying, well, I didn't vote for that legislation. And indeed they didn't. But as you say, if they didn't object, that it was it amounted to the same thing.
Right.
Peter
Pham,
go ahead. Sorry.
And certainly, I think that the key thing, though, is that objectives were laid out that had broad buy-in. I think everyone buys into the notion that this group needs to be eliminated. But I think where the debate and where Congress needs to exercise the oversight is how we actually go about doing that.
Yeah. Well, among other things, I expressed concern yesterday about the extent to which this is coming at a time when, you know, the budgets for our defense operations are being whacked. And I think there are other places where we have a responsibility to protect American citizens, particularly Iran at the moment, that we may be letting go unaddressed as a result of our preoccupations with some of these other applications of what seems to be the principle of a responsibility to protect, but that's for another day. Let me just quickly, while we have you, Peter Pham of the Atlantic Council, ask about another issue that seems to be developing at the moment in your region of expertise, namely the movement of Kenyan forces into Somalia. Can you tell us quickly in a minute or so what's going on there and where that may lead?
Well, in the last several weeks, Islamist militants from Somalia have been penetrating Kenyan territory, seizing Westerners, whether tourists or humanitarian aid workers, bringing them back into Somalia with the hope of holding them hostage for ransom to make some money. Kenya, seeing this take a hit to its tourism industry, which is its chief money earner, reacted by sending military forces into Somalia in the last 24 hours after the Islamist militants. My concern is not so much with Kenya's right to defend itself against an attack, but whether the Kenyans have the sufficient intelligence to identify their targets, whether they're actually sending sufficient forces to actually carry out the mission, or they're merely stirring up a hornet's nest that they'll be incapable of dealing with and, in fact, then forcing everyone else to worry about. And I'm worried that it's more of the latter. One of the Kenyan helicopters, in fact, crashed before it even left Kenyan territory.
Wow.
So,
we'll be watching it closely. Peter Pham, thank you. I hope you'll be helping us do so. I appreciate so much your work at the Atlantic Council, and thank you for joining us here at Secure Freedom Radio. Come back to us again very soon.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY, 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi. This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and listen to
the Gospel. I just got to stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say
sweater?
That?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back with the inimitable Andy McCarthy. I am thrilled to say, having read over the weekend one of what I consider to be his best pieces, and that is saying something, since so many of them are absolutely superb. He is, of course, a featured contributor to National Review Online, the author of two best-selling books, Willful Blindness and The Grand Jihad, and a featured guest of ours here at Secure Freedom Radio. Andy, welcome back, and congratulations on this new piece. It responds to the plot that was revealed, I think, since we last talked, involving allegedly the Iranians trying to blow up several people and sites in Washington, D.C. Tell us what you've taken away from that particular plot, and what you think we should be doing about Iran at the moment.
Well, I've thought for a very long time, Frank, that the problem in Iran is not what we seem to be obsessed about over the last 5 to 10 years, which is the nuclear program. The problem in Iran, the main problem in Iran, is the regime. And I think that for the sake of U.S. national security and global stability, the regime has to be toppled. I think that should have been the policy of the United States, frankly, going back at least to the 1990s, if not before. Certainly,
yeah. 79.
Well, 79, of course, but I think when they did Khobar Towers in 1996, the bombing in Saudi Arabia, which killed 19 of our airmen, I think that by that point in time, the scale should have fallen off everybody's eyes, and this whole dreamy idea of the, you know, the grand deal, the great rapprochement between the United States and this regime, the Mullah's regime, is simply something that's not ever going to happen. They're an implacable enemy committed to the destruction not only of American interests but of America herself. And I don't think that I don't think you organize a policy around somehow being able to come to a meeting of the minds with someone who is of that kind of mind. So I think that our policy ought to have been for a long time and ought to be now that regime has to be toppled. And I don't see that it happens without some military intervention.
Yeah. Your subtitle for the piece, Breaking Tehran, we're speaking about with Andy McCarthy, is Iran is at war with us and we must win. I couldn't agree with you more, Andy, and I think that the point that that is at least implicit in your piece is that we need to bring to bear all of the aspects of our power, including military, to this end. And I commend you for laying it out as starkly and as persuasively as you do. I also want to touch on something else that is a sort of subtext of this piece in National View Online, Andy, and that is your critical analysis of the, I guess for want of a better term, the democracy project. You say in one place in the piece, quote, there's also the perverse manner in which democracy promotion degrades democracy overseas and at home. Tell us what that point is about.
Well, I think that the places where we're trying to sow democracy, which is a violation of Sharia, which is the law of the places where we're trying to carry this project out, those places don't want democracy in the Western sense, which is the only kind of democracy that we ought to be promoting. So the way that we have gone about carrying off this charade of actually implanting democracy in these places is to do a sort of a blend of democracy and Sharia, which, as I point out in the piece, is sort of like doing a blend between Superman and Kryptonite.
Not good for his health.
No, and as I'd say, you know, look, you ask any persecuted religious or other minority in Iraq or Afghanistan how it's working out, you know, this blend of democracy and Sharia, places where I think shamefully our government and the State Department in particular has helped write these Sharia-like constitutions, and the next thing you find, for example, in Afghanistan is there are men put on trial for apostasy, capital trial. So I think overseas that's the effect. So what we're really doing is cheapening the idea of what real democracy is. And then, of course, at home, and I, you know, I don't carry any brief for the pastor down in Florida who thought, you know, burning the Quran in broad daylight to make a statement was a great idea. But the way our democracy works, you're allowed to push reprehensible ideas, and you're also allowed to push what may be good or at least credible ideas in reprehensible ways. That's the way a bumptious free society instead have, because of this ever-present fear of Islamic uprisings and violent reactions, is a tamping down of our own First Amendment rights, so that you have high government officials, including, you know, people like Senator Graham and General Petraeus, who came out after that stunt down in Florida and suggested that, you know, maybe the First Amendment wasn't such a great idea, which I think, to me, was a pretty frightening expression from American leaders.
Yeah, and it's made worse, really, by the fact that the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, is now, we're told, actively negotiating with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation on ways to bridge, as they say, between our First Amendment freedoms of expression and Sharia blasphemy laws. And Andy McCarthy, I'm not sure what kind of bridge there is there. At best, it's a one-way bridge to Sharia conformity.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And unfortunately, it's a project that this administration has had from day one. I think it's something that you could see foretold in a lot of the writings of Harold Coe, which is why a number of us were concerned about Coe becoming the lead lawyer at the State Department. And you could see it also in the resolution that was jointly proposed by the Obama administration and the Organization of the Islamic Cooperation, I think then led by, of all people, the Mubarak regime in Egypt, the former Mubarak regime in Egypt.
Ah, yes.
But this was a
proposed... remember them fondly.
Yes, right. but this was a proposed resolution to tamp down on free expression rights, and basically to say that it was incumbent on nations to use all their abilities of persuasion, including potentially the criminal law, basically regulate speech that was hostile toward religion, which translates into critical of Islam.
Right. Andy McCarthy is our guest for a few more moments. Andy, speaking of Harold Coe, there's a very nice smackdown of him, as you probably know, in the Wall Street Journal today by Bill McGurn. I commend it to everybody. The lawyer who has now tied himself into knots, justifying what he would have found entirely unacceptable in his previous incarnation. Andy, speaking of which, we seem to have gotten ourselves into another war since last we talked. You've written somewhat critically about it. We talked in the previous segment with Peter Pham about it. Tell us what your thoughts are on the advisability of what I think of as another application of the responsibility to protect in Central Africa.
Yes, the new war in Uganda. One of the things that the Obama administration sort of a bomb metaphorically that it dropped on us last Friday, I guess it was, in the Friday news dump, along with
the late Friday news dump.
Yes, the late Friday news dump, wherein we find that the deficit is actually almost bigger than it's ever been. And, oh, by the way, that little piece of Obamacare turns out to be never mind. In addition to all that, we learn that the president has decided to authorize combat action in Uganda. American troops will be sent there. Now, it's not a lot of American troops, but what I'm concerned about is exactly what you underscore, which is that what Obama is attempting to do here is twofold. Number one, try to legitimize this idea of the responsibility to protect doctrine, so that, you know, the use of American armed forces is not in pursuance of American national interest, but this idea of a global obligation to protect. It's hard to say exactly whom. I guess
civilians
decides. Yes, whoever the president decides needs the protection, even if, as in this case, we're jumping in on behalf of a government that is basically a military coup that's been in power since 1986.
No. Several unsavory partners in all of this, and they turn out not to get along very well with each other in these several African states. Andy, we'll be following it closely with you. Thank you for joining us, as always, and keep up the great work at National Review Online, and we'll be talking with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.